Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast where we talk about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hello, John. I'm doing great. How are you?
Excellent. I am doing great as well. I must admit, I'm a little bit tired because I've just been spending the last 2 days running full-day workshops about Swift UI. Which has been a lot of fun, really fun to run these workshops. But of course, as you know, you have also been doing training and workshops. It takes quite a lot of energy to do it, especially for a full day.
Yeah, like the one I did last week for Try Swift was really, really great. And it was only 2 hours compared to your full day one. So I can imagine it can be quite tiring.
Yeah, I've basically spent the last 16 hours or so, like if you combine the 2 days, talking about Swift UI, teaching the fundamentals, teaching advanced techniques, building a lot of user interfaces, talking about the state management, splitting views up, view architecture, all the good stuff, and doing a really deep dive on the layout system as well, which as I think you know, I'm a big fan of SwiftUI's layout system, and I find it really fun and fascinating to play around with.
Yeah, and it's been something I've enjoyed playing around with, the SwiftUI layout system and SwiftUI as a whole. Like, it's a really fun thing, but it's also a huge topic in and of itself, so I can imagine even with the 16 hours of workshop, it can be hard to choose what to present and to which level you want to show things. And also, you don't want to start like super, super basic, because that stuff is already available on Apple's website and things like that. But you also can't start too much into the woods, because then you're going to have people who haven't really seen any of that. So yeah, it's a tricky thing to balance.
Yeah, I still tend to start at the very basic level in my workshops. And that's also kind of advertised in the descriptions and things like that, so people know what they're getting into.
From scratch.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to assume any knowledge. And also, I feel like in general, there's been a lot of kind of theories in the community and speculation around how Swift UI works kind of under the hood and what are some of the best practices. And sometimes you hear kind of conflicting information, like, you know, should you use things like AnyView, for example, or how granular should you make your view updates? Where should you observe your state? Should you do it on the granular, smaller components, or should you have kind of a single source of truth in your app struct or in your app delegate that kind of updates your entire app as the state changes? There are many kind of different conflicting philosophies and conflicting ways of styling and architecting a Swift UI app. So I feel like I need to kind of start from the beginning to give my view on that, or to kind of start those discussions, so that, you know, you don't make the assumption that people know X, Y, and Z, and then when you get to that later point, then you realize that they might have had a completely different impression of those topics.
Yeah, exactly. And now that you've been involved with both using Swift UI and also teaching it quite a bit, what would you say is the key thing you've learned about Swift UI and that you see your students learning from your workshop? What's like the main thing to keep in mind when working with Swift UI?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I've now worked with Swift UI pretty much nonstop since it came out, which is at this point over a year ago. And I've been working on, you know, production level code with it. I've been working on many prototypes and some of my own tools and lots of different projects, you know, from all kinds of scales and all kinds of different variants. And that's been interesting because I've been learning it kind of continuously, kind of slowly but steadily over this time, right?
Yeah.
But here now I'm talking to people who, some of them are seeing it for the very first time. I mean, like you said, they've seen it at WWDC maybe, but they haven't used it. So they are essentially like beginners in the terms of Swift UI. And it's really interesting to see, you know, doing a very intense 2 days then of learning and seeing kind of what concepts they find intuitive, what concepts they kind of struggle to grasp. And again, what are some kind of misconceptions, if you will, or maybe sources of confusion. And I want to bring up two that I find in particular over the various trainings and workshops that I've done about Swift UI. And the first one is really how Swift UI makes this thing where UI is a function of state, like a core thing,
yeah,
where if you want to change the UI, you have to modify the state. This is something that usually takes a little while for people to get used to, where especially if you're coming from UIKit, you're so used to like calling methods on objects, attaching observers, and then like saying percent is alert, or saying like this button was now tapped, here's a function call. And in Swift UI, you just always modify the state. And especially, I always love this example of like how you present a sheet or an alert, that you use this state variable, like a state boolean, to decide whether the alert is presented or not. And also the way you kind of use modifiers and things like that, that's been a big one, like for people to kind of really get into, and get into this idea that you always modify the state if you want to change the UI. And then the second part is, I think a lot of people underappreciate or are not aware just how well Swift UI and UIKit integrate, just how relatively easy it is to bring a UIKit view into Swift UI. I use this example in my workshop where I bring a UI text view into Swift UI. So UI text view, you know, it's very powerful UIKit class. It has this underlying storage mechanism that is really powerful. You can do many, many things with it. And using like 10, 15 lines of code or something, I'm bringing that into Swift UI natively with like a text binding. So you can just bind it to a text just like you would with a text field. And that it usually tends to be pretty mind-blowing for people, just how easy it is to do things like that. Because I think a lot of people assume that you have to pick if you want to use either Swift UI or UIKit, or that you have to like rewrite your UIKit app in Swift UI. But I really, through these workshops, also really want to show people that it's absolutely 100% possible to mix and match, and especially reusing existing UI components and bringing them into Swift UI. There's a lot of tools available for that, and it's usually relatively easy to do so.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that my key learning, it lines up with what you mentioned about the UI being a function of state. We say this a lot, and even before Swift UI, there were lots of developers who brought this up, and most developers could realize that when your UI is not a function of your state, you end up with problems, because you end up with multiple sources of truth, and that can lead to bugs. And it's the main cause of bugs in most apps, I would say. It's the issue of UI not being synchronized with the underlying data. And yeah, Swift UI makes that pretty much impossible. And to do that, there are some changes you have to do in the way you think. And the best thing to do is to think about your UI as a function of state. And if you want something to change in your UI, you need that state represented in some way. So you can use, of course, at state, which you can use for like properties that are just for that view, or for an ephemeral state that's not particularly important. Or you can go further and use like a view model or some other sort of observable object. But yeah, that's the key learning for me as well when talking about Swift UI.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this is a modern trend also in other UI frameworks. For example, even UIKit with the new diffable data sources that were introduced last year in iOS 13.
Yeah, and React.
Yeah, and React and other kinds of frameworks, which also embraces this idea that the UI is always a function of state, and that there's a two-way binding between the UI and the state. And, you know, when you talk about these things, like, it might sound simple, like, yeah, just update the state and the UI updates. It sounds so automatic and easy. And in many cases it is, but then you can end up with these tricky situations where, you know, you were wishing for that method call that you could just call to like select this item or something like that. And in Swift UI, you have to like always have a state for it that you can then mutate in order to update the entire view.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So that's what I've been up to on kind of the work front. I've been preparing this workshop, running this workshop, and doing a bunch of different things around it, which has been a lot of fun. And I can also say, based on my just kind of general interest in Swift UI workshops and training in particular, I can tell you, Rambo, that there's a lot of companies around the world adopting Swift UI right now. I'm getting a lot of emails and questions from people around Swift UI and training and all those things. So interest in Swift UI seems to be very strong in the community, which it's fun. I know that there's some always debates around it, like, you know, in an alternate reality where Apple would not do Swift UI and just keep improving UIKit or something, would that be better? You know, we can debate those back and forth. But I'm in general really excited about Swift UI, and I think it feels like the community is really warming up to it as well, especially now where companies are dropping iOS 12 in many cases, and they're going to support iOS 14 and 13. It opens up a lot of doors to use Swift UI, which is fun for them and it's fun for me.
Yeah, definitely. I told you about the project we're doing at the Jobby Job, and it's now, I think the UI part is mostly done, and it was pretty much all done in Swift UI. Still using UI kits for the main building blocks, like the big containers like navigation and presentation of screens and things like that, but using Swift UI for the internal views themselves. And I've been adopting something like this for my own apps. Chibi Studio now requires iOS 13.5 and later, so I can freely use Swift UI where it makes sense, and I do plan on doing that. And it really lowers the bar for the difficulty level of implementing a UI. And I'm going to give an example when I talk about what I've been doing.
So please do. Let's hand it over to you, Rambo. What have you been up to?
I've been creating widgets for Chibi Studio.
All right. Now we're talking. You're really embracing all of the iOS 14 features here, aren't you? First app clips and now widgets as well.
Yeah, so widgets is an interesting thing because I didn't think it would make sense to make widgets for Chibi Studio. And I say widgets plural. I'll explain that. But what's the most obvious widget for Chibi Studio? It's a little square on your home screen with a chibi, right? A little character avatar in there.
Yeah.
But then I saw the craziness that happened with widgets and the kids, John, the kids all want widgets.
Yeah, they're demanding it. They're like hammering on your door, screaming like, give us those widgets, Rambo. What are you doing?
And I must confess something. I think I'm a kid.
All right, really?
Yes, because after making the widget for Chibi Studio, which I'm going to detail in a bit, I love it. Like, I've been looking at my home screen just because I want to see what's the chibi that's going to pop up next. Like,
that's awesome.
It is kind of cool, actually. But my thought process was that people were looking for widgets with some sort of usefulness to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's not the case. Like we talked about with the kids and TikTok and people customizing their home screens. People want their home screens to have some personality. And I think a chibi can be a good way to add personality to your home screen. So yeah, that's what I've been working on. And again, with adopting these things with Chibi Studio, it again presented some challenges. And this time, the main challenge was the memory limit for the widget extension, which is, I think, 30 megabytes, if I'm remembering this correctly. So you can't allocate more than, did I say 300? Or
no, 30.
Oh, okay. I thought I said 300. Yeah, you can't.
You can only get 3 gigabytes of memory.
Only 3 terabytes. So you can only allocate 30 megabytes of memory. And that's okay. Like, that's not like impossible to do anything, but it is limited. And when you're talking about rendering a chibi, I need to load all of the assets for the items in memory and render an image, which also happens to memory. Like, there is no easy way to render an image directly to the disk, which is not a disk, but anyway, we call it a disk. So I had to do some optimizations in my rendering pipeline and make sure I don't render in a size that's larger than necessary. Otherwise, I was running into memory issues.
That's really interesting. And is this also one of those cases where, because you had to do this optimization because of widgets, it also ends up benefiting your main app? Because that's so common, where you have like a more constrained deployment target, whether it's another platform, whether it's like in this case, a widget system. You perform all these optimizations in your code, and then your main target ends up being more efficient and faster as well. Was that also the case here?
Yep, that was the case indeed. Yeah, so my app is now a little bit more efficient thanks to me implementing a widget.
That's awesome.
And What's so cool about this is that it's really easy to add new extensions to Chibi Studio because of the way the app has been modularized for a long time. It is really simple to add a new target and link the required internal frameworks, and it all just works, trademark. so yeah, it's really fun. Like, it's not like, oh, it's this whole process that I need to configure a new target and move files around. No, it's just add a new target, add the framework. So I'm really happy with my modularization in there. And we've done some interesting stuff with the widgets. So I didn't know exactly what to do with the medium size. So the widgets, they have the small, which is a little square, the large, which is a large square, and the medium size is a rectangle, and it fills the width of the screen, but it's a little bit shorter in height. So I didn't really know what to do with that. First, I thought I would maybe show three chibis side by side, but that wouldn't work. That would be way too much memory to render three chibis. Right. But then I thought a little bit, and I thought it would maybe be cool to have a calendar widget. So,
ah, interesting. That's cool. So Chibi Studio is becoming a calendar app.
Exactly. So Chibi Studio will have a calendar widget, and we can leave a screenshot in the chapter art. But yeah, it's cool. Now it has a calendar widget, and I've done some interesting things. So you can configure the widgets with a few options. And one of them is something I find really cool, which is you can change the background color of the widget. And one of the background color options is a dynamic one, which is based off of your chibi. So you'll like sometimes get like the hair color of the chibi if it's like a colorful hair or something from the clothing, and it will create a dynamic gradient for the background. And if you're using the calendar widget, then the calendar text follows that. And that was also a fun little thing to do.
Yeah, that sounds super fun. Doing color math like that, like color sampling and figuring out the right color and the right contrast. Also, when you have a dynamic background, you need to make sure that the foreground has enough contrast to the background, right?
Yeah.
Stuff like that is always fun / challenging / sometimes a lot of work.
Yeah, and then the other option is the collections for the chibi. So you can choose from a random chibi, which is basically generated algorithmically. It will choose between the items available and just generate a random one, which results in some funny results sometimes.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And there's also the random from your library. So if you have lots of chibis in your own library in the app, it will randomize between those. And there's also a curated collection of chibis, which we've made, and we can update that remotely. And to update that remotely, I'm using CloudKit.
All right. That sounds super interesting, all of it. It sounds like your widget system is pretty complicated and involves a lot of steps. Could you perhaps walk us through like the steps involved in getting the data from your main app and rendered onto a widget? Like, what does the overall pipeline kind of look like?
So I chose to make the widget responsible for everything, basically. And by that, I mean not that like all of the code is in the widget target, but it leverages shared frameworks I have within the app, and it uses those APIs and assets to render. So I do everything inside the widget. So when a timeline request comes in, it will check the configuration that you've set using the intent, and based off of the configuration, it's going to fetch the chibi image, which can be a random chibi, which is the fastest one because it just like generates one and renders an image. It can be your library, which is slightly slower because it has to randomize from your library, which is a core data database. And the curated collection is the slowest because it will actually do a network request using CloudKit to the public database where it gets a random chibi. And in terms of sharing with the main app, I use app groups. So your preferences and stuff can be read by the widget. And the widget will also write, so when it generates a random chibi, for instance, it will save that random chibi to a file on the file system inside the app group. So when you tap the widget, it will launch the app and it will show the, we call it the import chibi dialog, which is a little screen that shows the chibi, and you tap a button and you add it to your library, because that's a chibi you don't have yet. So maybe you want to add it to your collection. So the trickiest part really was this saving of the random chibi to the file system, because that was tripping up the memory limits. Because right. I was first encoding the entire chibi as a property list using property list encoder. Chibis are codable. That's a good phrase.
Nice.
And that didn't work. But since my random chibi generation code doesn't really do much in terms of, like, it doesn't change the position of items or the colors or anything. It just selects a random list of items. I created this thing I call a chibi recipe. And this is basically just a container for a list of item identifiers, because that's all it needs, really. And that's all the random algorithm uses. So when you launch the app, it reads that little list, which is stored on the file system, and it then reconstructs the chibi from the recipe.
That's super interesting. And I love this kind of data optimization that you sometimes have to do in order to fit, like, memory constraints or something, like the work that you did there on your widget. Because it really forces you to kind of rethink your data and to try to find those optimization paths. Like, in this case, you could make assumptions on both ends of this data. Like, you know that data will only be in those specific configurations. You only know that it will contain data from this set, like this predefined item set that you already have. So you could vastly kind of almost like compress your data, but you could just express it in a much more lightweight way. And I just always find it fascinating to do that kind of work. And if I do like an app clip for the game that I'm working on right now, I know that I'm going to have to do a lot of that kind of work. And I know that you also had to do it for your app clip because you have to fit into such a narrow constraint with the download size of 10 megabytes. And it's interesting to hear that that's the case also with widgets. And I'm sure that I'm also going to encounter that soon as well.
Yeah. Also, ironically, I had to disable compression for chibis in the widgets because basically the standard code path for encoding and decoding chibis does compression using the LZMA algorithm. But that was causing too much memory to be used, because in order to compress something, you have to have the uncompressed data in memory, and you then compress that, and then you have both the uncompressed and the compressed data in memory at the same time. And that's, of course, not good. It's great for transmission and storage, but not in memory.
As anyone has found out when trying to decompress Xcode betas, right? Where the betas of Xcode this year were like 20 gigabytes or something.
Yep.
And you needed to have like 50 gigabytes of free space, which on my non-pro laptop was a bit of an issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm having the same issue with my secondary Mac here.
So, Ramble, before we move on to our In the News segment and our deep dive, we have a lot of fun things to talk about on this episode. We should also mention that we will do a deep dive on widget development soon as well. So you'll get more details around Ramble's widget development. Hopefully, I'll also have had some time at that point to do some widget development myself as well. So we'll share a lot of ideas on that soon. But you did do another thing during the last week, which I had the pleasure of experiencing. And that was to watch the intro of your app in spatial audio using the AirPods Pro, which was really amazing. So please tell our listeners a bit about this.
Yeah, so I figured out how to do spatial audio in a video. And the way it works is basically you have to create a 5.1 audio file, of course, because you need that surround sound. So I created one using Audition, which is my editor of choice, but you could create it anywhere, basically. And the trick was the way you produce the final video file. And to do that, you have to use Compressor, so the Apple app. And you have to use a specific preset, which I think is Apple Devices 4K. And you have to check a checkbox that says basically include 5.1 audio. So there are lots of little things you can miss during this process. And at first I was trying to encode it using HEVC. But for some reason, when you choose the HEVC preset, it won't include the 5.1 audio track. So, and on iOS, to play, you have to use AV Player, but it won't work with AV Audio Player. So if you want just the audio track, it doesn't work. And I think that's because spatial audio was conceptually made for video, right? So it's made for you to watch a video and feel like your device is a movie screen or something. So let's actually leave a link in the show notes to the video file. I am sure many of our listeners have AirPods Pro, so if you go to your show notes, you'll find a link. And if you open this link in Safari with your AirPods Pro on your iPhone or iPad, you'll be able to experience that.
Yeah, and I can really recommend it. It's almost like watching Chibi Studio launch inside of a IMAX movie theater, which is really, really amazing.
Nice.
So great job on that, Rambo. And I've been really enjoying spatial audio so far. It's really crazy, really, how it can work so well with just these two small little AirPods that you have in your ears, and you're watching something like, for example, the intro to C, the TV show C. Mm-hmm. I was rewatching the intro because it has all these like effects of sound coming from different directions. Ooh. And it's really fascinating to watch that, knowing that you only have one headphone in each ear, but it feels almost like sound is coming from all around you, which is, it's hard to describe on a podcast, but yeah. They did a great job on this, I think, Apple.
Now I want them to do that with HomePods, and we can have like 5 HomePods and we'll do Dolby Atmos or something.
I think you're the only person in the world who would want 5 HomePods, but okay, let's see if they're going to do that. But now let's move on to our In the News segment. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by Devon Technologies. Devon Technologies develops apps for taming the information flood based on their unique artificial intelligence technology. Their flagship product is the document and information manager Devon Think, and they also have other apps such as the web research assistant called Devon Agent, the desktop search assistant Devon Sphere, and more. They have been around since 2002, and they're really passionate about developing great Mac apps. So let me tell you a bit more about Devon Think in particular. Devon Think is a professional document and information management application for the Mac. It helps you collect, file, organize, edit, and annotate all kinds of documents without ever leaving the app, which lets you do things like place live web pages such as Google Docs seamlessly next to local files. You can organize documents in groups and subgroups, you can tag them or both, whatever suits your workflow the best. Using smart groups, you can also create different views into your data based on whatever criteria you can think of. You can also use Devon Think to archive email, to scan documents, and to work with PDFs. Devon Think also includes an integrated AI, which assists you with both filing and searching, and it also supports an extensive search language with advanced Boolean operators and support for custom metadata. That's perfect for programmers. And using their smart rules and their flexible reminder system, Devon Think also lets non-programmers easily automate many parts of their workflow as well, and to delegate their boring, repetitive tasks to the app itself. Syncing is of course also supported with a flexible sync engine that supports iCloud, Dropbox, WebDAV, as well as direct connections. And everything is securely encrypted, which lets you use their companion app, Devon Think To Go, to bring your documents with you at all time. And if that wasn't enough, you can also run Devon Think on the web with a brand new web interface that's ideal for small to medium-sized teams, as that lets people access your team's files even if they're not working on a Mac. Their latest version, Devon Think 3, was released last fall and features a completely modernized user interface with dark mode support and much more. And as a Stacktrace listener, you'll get a 10% discount on Devon Think 3 when you use the coupon code 9to5mac-20 at devontechnologies.com. Of course, we'll leave a link, that coupon code, and more information in the show notes. And by using that coupon code, you not only get 10% off DevonThink, but you also help support this podcast as well. So the coupon code is 9to5mac-20 and the URL devontechnologies.com. Thanks a lot to Devon Technologies for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so now let's move into our In the News segment. And the first thing we want to talk about is some quick updates to Apple's game streaming policies and to the game streaming world, if you will, in general. So, Rambo, you might have noticed a while back that Apple updated their review guidelines, right? This is something we mentioned on the show and we talked about a little bit and we said we're going to talk about it on a future episode. So here we are.
Yes.
And now game streaming is explicitly allowed, but there is a caveat, isn't there?
Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk.
Yeah, exactly.
So now they mention game streaming in the review guidelines, but the main limitation is that each game must be submitted as a separate app, right?
Exactly. So every game streaming client can only play one game at a time. Not even at a time, but in total, right? So if we take something like Microsoft's xCloud streaming service and their Game Pass subscription, the idea behind that app that was a bit of a controversy a few months ago was that Microsoft wanted to release an app on iOS that lets you stream any game from their game library onto your iPhone. And that's still not allowed, even with these updated review guidelines, because you cannot build an app and release it on the App Store where you have one app that can stream a large number of games. Now, the question is, do you think, Rambo, that companies like Microsoft or Google, who has their Stadia service, or there's also now a new service coming from Amazon called Luna, so it's like all of these big tech giant companies, pretty much all of them except for Apple, is getting into the game streaming industry? Do you think that these companies would go through the work of submitting each game individually, like basically to create like a thin client for each game on their service?
I think if they really want to be in the App Store, they'll end up doing it probably with like a white label type approach where they have like the single app and they just like change an ID in the build settings and it becomes the other game. I think maybe this is actually a technical problem because we know that the App Store system is quite old and it's based off of the original like iTunes Store. That's why to this day, developer, when you query the App Store API, the developer is called an artist because
right,
they didn't have the concept of apps. They just took this thing they had to sell movies and TV shows and music and started selling apps through it. So I think that the technical solution here, because I do understand Apple's position of wanting to have the game listed in the App Store as a separate entity, I do get why they want that, given that they don't want third-party app stores on iOS. I think it does make sense that Apple wants each individual game to have its own page in the App Store, basically.
And its own icon on the home screen, right? Like to behave like an iOS app.
Yeah, that as well. But I think the most important thing is they want users to be able to search the App Store and find that particular game, and to see screenshots of that particular game, and to see the age rating and description and all of the metadata in an App Store product page for the specific game, not for this thing that has 50 games. I do understand Apple's position here, but I think then they should provide a technical solution for that, which is not manually submitting different apps, which is wasteful even. I don't know, like some sort of proxy App Store page, which all App Store pages download the same app or something. I think there should be like a better technical solution for this problem, which Apple has created basically, because that's their policy. I do understand the policy. I don't understand why they haven't created a better solution for it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's interesting because you mentioned they're creating white label apps, and that's also a solution that I thought that they might pursue to basically have some kind of really just automation. Like, imagine that all the games are like stored on a file system on Microsoft servers. You could write a script that like iterates through all of those folders and then runs like an Xcode template, runs a script on an Xcode template, fills that in, like updates the bundle ID, like you said, links against that particular game data, and then uploads it to App Store Connect using the App Store Connect API, or even something using something like Fastlane or things like that, or using a CI service. Like, there are many options here. However, I also recall that doesn't Apple also have a rule against these automatically generated apps? Like, isn't there a rule in the guidelines that says, like, you can't just submit a large number of copies of basically the same app but generated with different content?
There is, but there isn't, and it's not enforced, kind of.
Yeah, it's one of those,
right? They introduced the rule, and then they started rejecting every app that looked even remotely like another app, and then people complained, and all of these companies were basically shut down by Apple because there are companies and their only job is creating white label apps. And then they changed it, basically stating that if you are providing apps for third parties, then each client must have their own developer accounts, which is fine, I guess. It's a fine limitation.
So every game will need to have their own developer accounts.
Yeah, I don't know how it works in that case, because then it's multiple apps from the same company with different brands.
Yeah,
And I exactly. think that's actually in the guidelines, that it's one of the allowed options, that if you have like an app with different brands for different markets or something, then you're allowed. Like, it's one of those rules, right?
That right.
they the enforce when they want to. And yeah, so and this is the problem with the App Store. We've talked about this before, and I've talked about with other people in other situations about this. The main problem for me is not that they charge 30%, although I would love for it to be less, but the main problem is the inconsistency and insecurity you feel being a developer, because anytime a bug fix update can be rejected for some weird reason, which was fine before and now it's not, and nothing changed. Like, this is mini rant here, because I've recently faced something like this with an update where it was rejected for no reason, basically.
Yeah, that's really troubling when that happens, and it's sad to hear that it keeps happening. But hopefully some of those situations will be resolved and things will improve. But to get back to the topic of Microsoft or another company submitting games individually, let's just imagine that it will be allowed and that it does work and that they can do it technically. I mean, we know they can do it technically because writing that kind of automation and script is definitely doable. But then you could argue whether or not they should, or whether or not that is actually a good policy. But if you think about it, that's actually exactly the same way that Apple Arcade works. Like, with Apple Arcade, you have a subscription, you go to the App Store, and you find all these individual apps, and you download them, and you can play them. And funnily enough, that's also how Xbox Game Pass works on the actual Xbox. So on Xbox, you don't stream the games from a server, you also download them to your Xbox and play them individually. So that's why I'm thinking that it's not completely far-fetched to think that this is something Microsoft might eventually do, because that's how it works on the Xbox, right? But they are now also seemingly debuting a new app that lets you also stream directly from your Xbox console instead of from the cloud. So they're going kind of the same approach as Sony has been doing with the PlayStation streaming app, where you can stream from your own PlayStation. So that's kind of an interesting, I don't want to call it a workaround, because this was probably planned as well as a separate kind of product, but it's just an interesting different take on the whole kind of game streaming concept. And I wanted to bring up a final thing here on this topic, which is Amazon's strategy for iOS, which is interesting because it's different. And it's that they are planning apparently to run their game streaming service, which is going to be called Luna, which is coming soon. On iOS, it's going to run in Safari. And you might think, running a game in Safari, that doesn't sound like that would work. But the cool thing, or the interesting thing, is that you can actually run games in Safari on iOS. You can even do things like gamepad support in JavaScript on iOS in Safari. That has worked since iOS 10. So there are the technical capabilities to do that. And if you also add the fact that you can take a web page and save it as a clip onto your home screen, and you have a game streaming service, so the game is actually running in the cloud, not in the browser. It's only streaming the image to the browser and sending the input back to the cloud. This is an, I'm really, really interested to see how this is going to work out for Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, using a browser may sound like a crazy idea, but browsers are really powerful, right? You have WebGL and all of the cool stuff you can do. You have game controller support. So I think that's a, might I say, sweet solution.
I see what you did there. And that's an interesting way for them to basically work around these App Store limitations. So you have all these different strategies happening here. You have all these big company kind of policies clashing against each other, and Amazon like kind of circumventing that by going to the web. So I'm just kind of curious to see how this will all play out. I am, in general, really excited about game streaming. I can't wait to be able to play games like that on my phone, even when I'm not at home, eventually in the future. So, I think this is just an interesting thing that we will keep following.
Definitely.
So, Rambo, what else is in the news lately?
John, there's a new conspiracy around.
Ooh, is it a good conspiracy? Is it a bad conspiracy? What kind of is it?
Did you know, John, that iOS 14 widgets are secretly reading your keyboard?
I did not know that.
Do you think that's possible, John?
I don't think that's possible because widgets are data, right? Like they're serialized Swift UI views. They're not fully running apps in the background. Like the timeline extension and the widget extension that you talked about building earlier, that's your executable code, but your actual widget that lives on your home screen, that's just a serialized Swift UI view.
Yeah. So I think this shows just how popular iOS 14 widgets became, that a conspiracy theory was made about them.
Right.
That's how you measure the popularity of something, right? If a conspiracy theory is made, then it must be successful. So there's been this rumor. It's not even a rumor. Like, rumors usually have some sort of truth, but people notice that on iOS 14, the keyboard lags sometimes, which is a bug that's been around since the early betas of iOS 14. And it's gotten better, but it still happens, especially on iMessage, where sometimes you'll be typing and the keyboard will hang. And people associated that with widgets, and that widgets are reading your keyboard, basically acting as keyloggers. Of course, our audience doesn't need to have this explained to them because they know better, but just in case someone you know is sharing this stuff, you can refer them to this podcast or to the 9to5 Mac blog post we'll share in the show notes. No, it doesn't happen. It can't happen. Like John mentioned, widgets, they're basically a snapshot of a tiny moment of execution, which wouldn't be enough to constantly read anything, much less your keyboard, which no app on iOS can read. And yes, I know there have been vulnerabilities way back where there could be maybe a way to keylog on iOS, but that's not possible these days. And definitely not with a widget. A widget would be the worst way to do that.
Exactly. And this is one of those areas where the limitations, in this case, of the widget system and in general of iOS as a platform, where all apps are sandboxed and keyboard control is really tightly controlled by the system as well. Like every time you focus a search field or a text field, the keyboard will pop up, like the software keyboard, right? So doing something like a keylogger wouldn't really make much sense on iOS to begin with, because the keyboard only appears when you type into a search field or search box, and there's no way for an app to like globally observe the keyboard across different processes because it's kind of technically limited by the sandboxing model.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think it's interesting also how a bug, basically, which is the keyboard lagging, can become something more than just an annoying bug. Like, if this bug wasn't there, this probably wouldn't have happened. But again, if people were not so gullible, this also wouldn't have happened. So, yeah, I know our audience doesn't fall for this type of stuff, but it's just sad.
It's also interesting how people in general, ourselves included, like, it's easy to look at this because we know the technical aspects of this, we know how it works, so it's easy to look at this and laugh and be like, you know, what are they thinking, right? But I'm sure that we also make assumptions within other scenarios where we draw conclusions that are not true based on some kind of intuition or based on what we think. So for example, like in this case, you know, I can see someone jumping to the conclusion of like, they updated their OS, they downloaded a bunch of widgets, and now all of a sudden their keyboard is really slow, that, you know, there's that kind of association happening where new widgets must equal the reason that keyboard is slow. Why is the keyboard slow? They're probably reading all the data, right? So, you know, it just shows that it's usually good if we can draw some kind of learning from this as people. Maybe it's that to not jump to conclusions too quickly, right?
Yeah, and there was also another factor, which is like the perfect storm that would make this happen, which is that iOS 14 introduces a new compromised passwords feature, which alerts when one or more of your passwords have been compromised in known data breaches. And people have been receiving those notifications after updating to iOS 14. So that's more fuel to the fire, right? Updated to iOS 14. I've added some widgets. My keyboard is lagging. And I just got this notification that my password has been compromised. Oh, my God.
I wonder why.
Yeah. So also there might be some usability aspect in there. Maybe there should be some sort of onboarding of this compromised password feature. Or even like, but this would become a whole other topic. Maybe we can talk about this in another episode. But I think maybe this compromised password feature should be opt-in, because I think most people don't understand what it means.
Right.
Or there should maybe be some sort of education. But then again, how do you do that on a phone? Like, people just dismiss those. So yeah, it's a complicated subject.
Yeah, it really is. And this is one of those areas where how you phrase things in the user interface really makes a big difference. And one thing I've noticed in general, I'm not going to say that it's just in the latest release, but I have noticed in general a trend where Apple is using more and more kind of technical language in their dialogues and in the user interface. One thing that comes to mind is the contact tracing notifications. Like when you enable contact tracing for COVID-19, it says something like, your device will exchange unique identifiers with other devices. It is like, unique identifiers sounds so much like a very technical term.
Or like something like my address.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so yeah, I think this is something also to keep in mind when we're writing these kind of texts, especially if you're the developer writing these texts, to try to not use technical terms. At least I try to do it. I'm sure I sometimes fail, but it's one of those things that if you make it too technical, it can also sound either scary or people can, again, draw the wrong kind of conclusions from it.
Yeah, the Brazilian app for COVID tracking, I just launched it here to see if they had changed the text, but the home screen of the app has a little banner where you can tap and see your exposure log, so if there's been any exposure. And the title for this banner is, and I'm translating here, possible exposure. That's right. The title. So you look at that and you think, oh my God, I've been exposed. And then you tap, there's been no exposure detected. That's like, why is that the title?
It was one of those things where we talk about on a previous episode, I believe, where you would get push notifications from these contact tracing apps, and it would just say, like, everything's okay. But it's like, when you see that push notification and you haven't unlocked with Face ID yet, you get really scared. So yeah, user interface design, it can be scary sometimes.
Oh yeah.
Cool. So now, Rambo, let's move ahead and do some Ask Stacktrace. We will get back to doing deep dives again. We have lots of deep dives lined up. So there will be a new deep dive on the next episode. But for now, let's do some Ask Stacktrace and answer your questions. And to remind everybody, you can always tweet at us with the hashtag Ask Stacktrace with any question that you would like us to answer on the show. It can be something related to what we talked about. It can be something brand new, something that's going on in the community or in the news. We're up for any questions that you want to ask us. So just use the hashtag Ask Stacktrace. And the first person who has done that this week is Ryan. And Ryan phrased this question to me specifically, and he said, "John, on various podcasts, you've mentioned view models and MVVM, but I found a lot of conflicting ideas about it, such as using state machines versus not. So I'd love to hear more about how you use it, especially in Swift UI." So Swift UI, MVVM, view models, really fun topic. But before I give my answer here to Ryan, I also want to hear your answer to this, Rambo. So when you use view models, how do you typically use them? Do you let them just be kind of more simple data containers? Do you put your logic inside of there? How do you typically model your view models?
So SwiftUI completely changed the way I use view models. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how it used to be and what I'm doing when working with SwiftUI. So what I used to do, and there is still code of mine out there which uses this concept, was to use view models as basically just an adapter between a model and a view. So they were usually structs, value types, and they would be initialized with an instance of a model and provide formatted properties or some sort of transformation stuff for the view, but they wouldn't do much. Like, they would be basically data containers, as you mentioned. So that was before SwiftUI. Now with SwiftUI, what I've been doing is I've been creating view models, which are observable objects, and they publish properties for the view, and they actually do have some logic in them to manipulate the model and to do operations. So going back to the example of my widgets, I created a little publication flow for the curated collection that I mentioned, which uses CloudKit. And the way it works is when you're running an internal build of the app and when you are an admin, which is something I did using security roles on CloudKit, you can go into a chibi in the library and send it to this curated collection. But this is not just a send process, because there are some fields you can choose between, like if this expires after a while, if this should be published later, if this is just for a particular locale, or if this should be just for a specific app version or something like that. So there's a little form for the admin to publish this. And that was done using SwiftUI. And this is why I mentioned that SwiftUI lowers the barrier to making this, because I would not have made this with UIKit. It would have been a pain. Like, this is something that's just for internal use. So SwiftUI was a great fit, and I made it super quickly. And the way that form works is there is like a publish form view model, not to be confused with Sundell's publish.
This is Rambo's publish.
Yeah, but there's a little publish form view model or something like that. And you mentioned state machines in the question, and the view model actually has a property called state. And this is an enum, and it can be like idle, or it can be uploading, it can be error, and it can be done. I think those are the options. And error has an associated value, which is an error message. And the view model publishes a property, which is that state. So in my view, I can switch on that state and display the form or the upload progress or something like that. And I do the same for the AirBuddy feedback form, which we mentioned before. So in this case, my view model is kind of a state machine as well. So it holds this little state thing. And does the transformations. But of course, I'm not like doing the actual network requests and things like that in the view model. That's deferred to another thing, which is just a plain old object.
All right, that sounds really cool. And I love that you mentioned there that you've been using view models in the past more as just kind of plain data, right? Like as structs. Mm-hmm. And now you are using view models that are more kind of sophisticated. They have like a life cycle. They have their state machines. And I tend to use both of those kinds, even sometimes within the same project. And I don't think that either of those are wrong. I think both of those are following kind of the idea behind view models. It depends really on like what kind of view we're dealing with. So for example, if you're dealing with a simpler view where you just have some view state that you want to put somewhere, you could just use like at state variables inside of your Swift UI view. But if you wanted to group them together and encapsulate them a little bit, you could do that using a struct. So you could just have a struct called your view model. It contains your properties that your view needs to read and write from. And that's it. Like, that's your view model. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And then you can create the other kinds of view models, which are more kind of these state machines that we mentioned. And I think that is great as well. So for example, if I have a login screen and it can be in a state like idle, like you mentioned, it can be like logging in, like the login is in process. It can be login failed. Those are great also because now you can encapsulate all of those transitions and all of those states inside of that view model object and just publish that state property. And then the view, like you also mentioned, Rambo, can just switch on that and render the proper user interface. That is really nice in Swift UI, I think. So I completely agree with that approach as well. One thing that I typically do is that when I have view models, if they are these kind of observable objects, these more sophisticated state machines, I also try not to do like my database code, my networking, my file IO, like that kind of code in a view model. That I typically delegate to controllers. So I will have like a file IO controller, network controller, like a login state controller, user controller, and so on and so forth. And I will then inject those into my view model. So the view model will essentially use my core logic, which is my controllers, and then call those, observe those, make requests with those, and then modify its state. And then, like we said, when you want to do anything in Swift UI, you always modify the state. So it just modifies its state, Swift UI picks that up and re-renders the view. And that I found is a pretty neat architecture in Swift UI because it lets you keep your core controllers completely focused and focus on their tasks. They can be very kind of stateless in general, and maybe they do some caching and things like that, but they can just respond to requests. And then the view model can just translate that information into something the view can read and render. And then the view can just be focused on the rendering itself. So you're creating this kind of layered architecture where you have your core logic, you have your view models, and your views. I think that's a super nice way of using view models. But if you don't need any of those kind of controller level logic or anything like that in one particular view, I also don't think it's weird to just create a view model that's a struct if you want to do that. I think that works as well.
Yeah, definitely. For instances where, say, you want to display a bunch of things in a list and you don't need any logic associated with each item on the list, which wouldn't really make sense anyway, but you do need to do a lot of formatting and things like that, it really makes sense to have a view model or whatever you call it that just takes your model and adapts its content to be better shown inside the view. And the thing you mentioned about having those controllers and things like that is also very useful because you can have your view model be somewhat abstracted away from the actual operations it's performing, such as networking and database and things like that. And that can be really useful for your previews, where you can then manipulate your view model for each preview so that you can see what your view is going to look like in different states of your view model.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the further you go down your view hierarchy, like the more you go to more your core view components, the more likely I am to use that more lightweight struct-based view models. Yeah. Or even not use view models at all. Like, I don't think every single Swift UI view needs to have a view model. I think sometimes if you have a more simple view with maybe just a state or maybe no state at all, you don't need a view model. You can just put those properties directly in the view and that's fine. And the beautiful thing about Swift UI also is that it's usually very easy to refactor. Mm-hmm. So if you find yourself adding too many properties in a view, there's too much going on, you could usually encapsulate those, like move those to a view model, and you just have to update, like instead of saying dot name, you say view model dot name, right? Mm-hmm. And that usually just works. So I think, like to Ryan's question here, like around these being conflicting ideas, I'm not sure if I think they're conflicting ideas. I think they're just multiple takes on the same pattern. And in fact, I wrote an article a while back now, which was before Swift UI, which is called Multiple Flavors of View Models in Swift. So we'll leave a link to that in the show notes as well, where you can just see, even back then, I thought that there can be many different takes on the view model concept. I don't think there's just one single take that is valid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And then we have our final question for this week. And this one comes from Bastian. And Bastian wants to hear, now that Swift has officially been released on Windows, which is really exciting news, could you guys see yourself port some of your stuff to Windows? So what about you, Rambo? Will we see Chibi Studio for Windows anytime soon?
Well, of course, most of our listeners will know that the language is just one part of it, right? So there is the entire rest of the Apple ecosystem and frameworks and things like that, which is not on Windows. But I do enjoy the reality that Swift is becoming more and more a cross-platform language. So whenever I want to build something for Windows, I can write it in Swift, which is a language I'm familiar with, so I don't need to at the same time be dealing with a platform and frameworks I'm not familiar with, and also a language I'm not that comfortable with, but I can do it in Swift. So I think that's really cool. I have explored, I think we mentioned it here, AirBuddy for Windows, but the reality of Bluetooth low energy support on Windows is such that I really don't see it happening anytime soon. I'm sorry.
All right. We won't keep our hopes up then. I feel similar to you. Like, of course, being able to compile and run your code like on a command line on another platform, that is step zero, right? That's like the thing you need to even get started. Then you need bindings to all the native frameworks, especially the UI frameworks on the platform. So, you know, you wouldn't want to just draw kind of rectangles and colors and fonts directly in Swift in an app on Windows. You would want to use Windows native controls, right? You want your Windows app to feel at home on Windows. All of the things we always talk about around web apps and Mac apps, the same thing applies here, I think. Like, if I wanted to release something on Windows, I wouldn't want it to just feel like a Mac app that was moved to Windows, right? Yeah. Or just like some kind of vanilla UI that doesn't feel at home. I would want it to be a proper, native, nice-looking Windows app, right? Following all those design conventions. One thing, though, that intrigues me about this is my game development things, where I could see myself... I'm not going to make any promises. I mean, I haven't even released my game yet. So let's take that step first. Let me release it on Apple's platforms first. But since I have abstracted my game in a way where all of my game logic is essentially just Swift code that only relies on the standard library, like it doesn't use any like Swift UI or Imagine Engine, my game engine, like that code does not kind of bleed into the game logic. The game logic is completely isolated. So I think I could take my game logic, which by the way is a Swift package, and I could build that on Windows and it would probably just compile. And that's pretty exciting because that means that the core of my game runs on Windows now. I haven't tried it, but you know, in theory, it should. So that means I could start with something like a command line interface to the game, and you could actually play the game on the command line on Windows. Probably most people wouldn't want to do that. But what that means is that I could then write like a Windows wrapper using, for example, DirectX, which is the graphics library on Windows. That would be like a game renderer, which would then talk to my Swift game logic, and I could then share that across platforms. And that is intriguing to me. So maybe at some point, maybe during like the holidays or something, if I will have more time, I will try doing that. I need to actually get a Windows machine. I don't think I have one in the house. But, you know, baby steps. But this does intrigue me, and I do see myself potentially in the future somehow doing something with Swift on Windows. I think it's super exciting.
How about porting Imagine Engine to Windows?
Oh, that's a bigger one, isn't it? But I mean, if I'm going to do that DirectX rendering engine, which, by the way, DirectX is Microsoft's basically equivalent of Metal or OpenGL, if you will. They also support OpenGL, but that's their native rendering tools for GPUs. Then maybe, I don't know, like never say never, right?
I ported it to the Mac, John. It was so easy. Just do it.
Yeah, just do it. All right. And I think that is a great way to end this week's episode of Stack Trace. So all that remains is for us to thank our great sponsor, Devon Technologies, for helping us make this episode possible. And of course, to all of you for listening to our show. If you liked what you hear, feel free to tell us about it on social media, for example, on Twitter, share it with a friend, leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts, or just enjoy next week's episode. It's all up to you. But that's it for this one. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.